For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Now, 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program will feature three different interviews, beginning with a look at a brand new and delightful children's book. And we're spending these next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking with celebrated children's book author Barney Salzberg. He has quite a number of different books to his credit, the most recent being Arlo Needs Glasses, a lovely little book that also has a little bit of reflection with Barney Salzberg's own life. He is published many times an award-winning children's book author. He has also done some work for the PBS show Arthur. His list of credentials is a long one, and this last book, or most recent book, is especially lovely, and I think a lot of people will identify with its main character. It's published by Workman Publishing. Barney Salzberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, what a treat to be here. Thank you.
Glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about the book specifically, tell us about this intriguing part of your biography when you say that you fell in love with drawing very early on, primarily with the encouragement of your mother. What did your mother do to help foster what obviously is a significant talent?
Thank you. My mom was, I think she would have loved to have been an artist herself. She was a little too critical about her own work to allow that, but she did not believe in coloring books. She felt like I should be creating my own artwork and bought me sketchbooks from the time I was a little kid. And I have boxes of them in my studio now. She saved all of them. And I just brought it with me wherever I went and would draw things that were in our house, things I saw. We would take, whether I went to the market or on a vacation, I would have a sketchbook with me. And I think that planted the seed at an early age. And I did not, no one would have ever looked at my artwork at that point and thought, he's got a career doing this. It was tenacity that really made this work.
Hmm. This last book, your most recent book, Arlo Needs Glasses, is absolutely lovely. One of the things I want to say about it right off the bat, besides the fact that it's just a really sweet, fun story, is also that this book is quite brief. And one of the things I really like about that is that some children's books are not. They kind of go on and on and on. And sometimes, to my amateur eyes, it seems like maybe they go on a little too long. And there's a really wonderful, succinct directness to this book. Can you just talk about kind of the typical span of your books and what you think about in terms of how quickly and succinctly to tell a given story?
It's an interesting phenomenon because picture books are traditionally 32 pages, and then they go to 48. It's just the way the print runs are done. This book was originally a pop-up book. I had written it as a picture book, and my editor at Workman thought it would make a great pop-up book. So pop-up books are very hard to make and expensive to make, and there's a lot of bells and whistles in them, and paper prices and labor gets costly. So they shorten the length of a story for that very reason. To have 32 pages that are all interactive would be extremely expensive. So it allows you to write a story in a shorter page span. And this book, they decided to release it as a picture book. I think it was a cost savings for them, but what it was wonderful for me because it showed their faith in this story, that regardless of whether it was an interactive book or not, it still had a story that resonated. So it's not typical to see a story this short. I haven't even counted how many pages are in it, but it's definitely not 32 pages.
Right. But again, it's one of the things I like about it. I think it works absolutely great. Mm-hmm. We should explain to our listeners who, or let's say what, Arlo is, as in the title, yeah. Arlo Needs Glasses.
Well, Arlo, I like working with animals. I find that it's less threatening when you're dealing with a lot of subject matters for kids to see it one step removed from it being a human being experiencing this. So I had a 85-pound giant white golden doodle that people used to stop me and take pictures with when I would walk him down the street, and he could not catch a ball. So I thought he was the perfect character to, A, he planted the seed for the story, and he was just so cute. How could I resist drawing him? So that's why he was born into the story.
So you happen to be someone who wears glasses, so I have a feeling you resonate with this particular story. Tell us more about how it took shape.
Well, when I as Arlo got bigger and bigger, from I got him as a small little puppy, I really wanted to have a dog I could play ball with, and it was clear from the moment I threw a ball that this was not going to be the dog for that. He just some people want to have a frisbee dog. I wanted a ball dog. He just didn't have the coordination to catch, and it was funny and kind of sad all in the same breath. And my brain is always going to, how can I turn something into a story? It drove my kids crazy when they were growing up. Any situation to me was a potential story. And when I saw a dog that couldn't catch, I thought, well, how could I help him? And wouldn't it be wonderful if he could wear glasses? And then it thought, well, this is the perfect story to have to model to kids, that this is a process you go through. You go to the eye doctor, they check your eyes. It might be a little scary, but I'm hoping to take some of that out by showing it happening in the story with a dog going through the steps. And they do show you what the eye chart looked like to the boy, and then how it looked to the dog, which went from clear to fuzzy. And then using the machine, which I didn't know until I wrote the book, was called a phoropter that you look through when they check your eyes. I think mine's more friendly than the ones you see at an eye doctor. Mine has a dog bone on it and some pretty fun colors, but I'd be happy to paint any eye doctor's phoropter for them. And then the idea that you get to look through all these fun glasses and pick some out. So I wanted to make it a potentially scary new situation into a much more fun, familiar situation once this story had been read.
So we haven't yet mentioned the fact that not only did you construct the story, but you are also the illustrator of this book. Yes. Is that typically the case with this and some of your other books, like Beautiful Oops and so on? Are you always the illustrator?
I'd say out of 50 books, I illustrated 47 of them. The rare time someone else has come in, but yeah, I usually illustrate my own. And there's a lot of author illustrators out in the world, and then there are plenty who are just illustrators and some who are just writers. But I love having to get to do both. I have a vision, and it's something that only I can really execute myself. Someone else could step in and interpret my text their own way, but I like having control of it.
Right. And I just wonder kind of how complicated is that part of this, in terms of once you have created the story and crafted the words, then in a sense melding the visual illustrations to that story. I mean, even when it's just you, I mean, doing it all, how complicated is that process?
way more than it looks. People assume that this is just a fun, easy job. And I always tell people I had all my hair when I started. not there anymore. I learned something beautiful from Maurice Sendak, who was famous for many books, but Where the Wild Things Are. And they did a book about his life, and he talked about the process of illustrating. And he differentiated illustrating with the word illumination. And what can you add to the story in the visuals that might not be in the text? And it does add, because if you just draw exactly what you wrote, it can be rather flat. And if you can add something to it that might illuminate the text, it makes a richer story. And that process of finding ways to have some sometimes subplots that are happening visually or facial expressions that might add more emotion to the story, those things take time to figure out. So I might do some quick sketches along the way, and sometimes when because I do both, I might be drawing while I'm writing. I'll go back and forth, and a body position that I wasn't even thinking about might suggest an emotion that I might not have come up with had I just been writing. So for me, it's a back and forth. I don't always wait until the story is completely written before I start drawing. I also do, it's almost like a casting call. Who's the character in the story? I try out different characters. Hmm. It could be a human. It could be an animal. I never know. Although Arlo had to be a dog.
And,
my dog.
And I'm glad he's a dog. And it's a lovely, lovely story and a lovely book. Again, Arlo Needs Glasses, a children's picture book from Workman Publishing, and the man responsible for it, Barney Salzberg. Barney Salzberg, thank you for being my morning show guest, and keep up the good work. We enjoy your book so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going into the morning show archives for one of my all-time favorite interviews with best-selling author Robert Kersen. Well known for a number of different books, including Shadow Divers and Rocket Men, this conversation surrounds a book that was published back in 2007 called Crashing Through, a true story of risk, adventure, and the man who dared to see. It is the true story, the amazing story, of a man named Mike May, blinded at the age of 3, who was able, through a revolutionary stem cell transplant surgery, to have his sight restored. This book is a chronicle of what that experience was like for Mike May to be blind for so many years and then suddenly to be able to see again. The book again is titled Crashing Through, a true story of risk, adventure, and the man who dared to see, published by Random House. Describe to our listeners, Mr. Kersen, the really strange and nearly tragic accident which blinded Mike May back at the age of 3.
He and his family had just moved to a new house in New Mexico into a mining town. And Mike was exploring his backyard and his garage, as many 3-year-olds would do. And he found a glass jar filled with some kind of powder. And he wanted to make mud pies, so he wanted to get the powder out. And he rinsed the jar out. But what was in the jar was some explosive chemical, and it created fumes and then ignited with a nearby burning fire and made this horrific explosion that tore Mike's face and body apart. He was rushed to the hospital where he required 500 stitches and spent 6 months in the hospital, during which his mother was told several times to say goodbye to him, that this was the end, her son was not going to pull through. When he finally did make it and came out after 6 months, his mom believed that the return of her son was such a gift and so unlikely that the fact that he was made totally blind by it and would never see again seemed like a very small price to pay.
As we have heard in other cases, Mike is able to build for himself a rich and very, very happy life, a life very much complete without vision. And I want you to talk for just a moment, because I think your book offers some very rich insights into how someone like Mike and other people who are blind manage to move about the world and do amazing things, primarily through the use of other gifts and other senses when they are deprived of sight. Talk for a moment about how Mike May did this.
Well, that's beautifully stated and completely true. Mike, really, from the moment he came home from the hospital, was told by his mother in no uncertain terms that he was going to do everything and try everything and experience everything in life that a sighted person could and then some. That while this was an impediment, it was certainly not to stop him from the full experience of life. And that was the first message he came home with from the hospital. And in fact, she made good on that message within days by moving the family 1,000 miles so that Mike could attend one of the 6 or 7 public schools in the country at the time that would accept a blind student. So very early on, Mike had this message, you must try and you must speak to your curiosity. Now, you're totally right. There are incredibly capable blind people out there who use all kinds of different skills and senses to make huge and full lives for themselves, including echolocation and wonderful, reading and listening skills, all kinds of things, all of which Mike had. But the thing that really took him through the world was this curiosity, that he felt compelled to try things. And so, for example, in fourth grade, he became the school's crossing guard, over the objection of his principal, by the way. He climbed a 175-foot ham radio tower as a young teenager to adjust the antenna for its owner. He went on to build schools in Ghana for a year, to become the CIA's first blind analyst, to become the co-inventor of the world's first laser turntable. Not because he thought all those things needed to be doing as much as he believed he needed to see what it was like to do them. Hmm. And that's really how he went through life early on.
And, of course, it speaks very much to this incredible experience he ultimately has that you talk about in your book, when he says that he embraced the possibility of getting lost. You say to go where May wanted to go, which was everywhere, one had to be willing to get lost, a terrifying prospect to many blind people. To May, getting lost was the best part. And he, in answer to the question of how he'd gotten so good at traveling with a cane, he said it was his curiosity, not his cane, that got him where he needed to go.
That's pretty good writing, I have to say.
It certainly is.
That's exactly who he is. He was backward in a lot of ways that you might expect if you had no experience with blind people. You would think, oh, my God, it's terrifying to go in the dark and get lost. I mean, all of us sighted people have turned off the light at some point and felt around to see what is it like to be blind, right? And it's never a pleasant experience. At least it's not for me and the people I've talked to. It's scary. And yet Mike was saying, if something's not scary and unknown, it's not that interesting. But if it is scary and unknown, you never know where you're going to end up. And it was that idea that he could wind up anywhere that drove him. And that's ultimately what's going to explain the rest of this story. That was such an unlikely thing.
Hmm. Yes, it is a case of Mike May not being particularly hungry to find vision again. Of course, the thought is all but unthinkable when someone has been completely blinded at the age of 3, and he's built this wonderful life, professional success, a wife and 2 sons. In a sense, vision comes looking for him and not the other way around. Tell us about this extraordinary encounter which leads to this tantalizing prospect of a surgery with the aim of perhaps restoring his sight.
Right. He's walking around 43 years completely content. His life is full. It's busy. It's rich. He's a world record holder in skiing for the blind. He is running a company that's on the cutting edge of technology, making GPS systems for the blind. This is the furthest thing from his mind that he's going to see ever again. He was assured he wouldn't from age 3. And then he goes with his wife, because she scratched her contact lens, into the office of a doctor in San Francisco that could give her a last-second appointment just to replace her contact lens. He doesn't even want to go with her. He'd rather walk around San Francisco. She says, oh, just come with me. It'll be 10 minutes. So begrudgingly, he says, all right. So he goes in. And he stumbles across one of the four or five ophthalmologists in the country who's familiar with this very rare stem cell transplant procedure that can give vision to people who were blinded either by chemical explosion or by a rare genetic disease. Only those candidates, very few. And they get to talking, and the guy says to him, essentially, I can make you see. And this is a thunderbolt from the sky. This is a total accidental encounter. And he says, let me know. If you want to do it, I can make you see. And, you know, you think to yourself, well, wouldn't he say yes right on the spot? I mean, I remember having discussions with people in college where we said, if you, you know, which would you opt for, going blind or dying? I mean, that's how central vision is to some people, right? And yet Mike says, let me get back to you. Not only does he not get back to him that day, he doesn't get back to them that week or that month. And in fact, he says many months later to the guy, thanks, but no thanks. My life is already full and rich without it. No, thank you. So it looks like the story's over.
Right. And
that's not where it ended.
Of course. One of the things that is so interesting in his wrestling with this question, again, quoting some very good writing, you said May began to think a lot about who he was. For decades, May had believed that blindness was cool, that life was every bit as good without vision, that there was always a way. Faced with the loss of his blindness, he could imagine a world in which the special things he did became routine. The notion of seeking vision felt like a divorce to him. I'm especially intrigued by that, the way you phrase it, of being faced with the loss of his blindness. I mean, that the prospect of gaining sight, at least in the early going, felt more like a potential loss of sorts.
That's right. He was, in every bit, in every way, extraordinarily comfortable in his world. But more than that, he was looked up to by blind and sighted people alike. Here was a guy who you really could aspire to, who blind kids could aspire to and sighted kids could aspire to. He was looked up to. He was admired. He was a gold medalist. He had all these accomplishments. And yet, he said to me, in what I thought was a very honest moment, if I became sighted, then I was just another guy. Then going off to New Zealand on a business trip didn't mean much anymore. You know, finding my way from San Francisco to Chicago on the bus was no big deal anymore. I was just average. And it was a very unsettling thing for him. Who was he after all these years if he wasn't Mike May, the blind guy? And that was threatening to him.
He ultimately does make the decision to go through with this surgery. Summarize for us what the tipping point was.
Well, he has, first of all, the doctor explains these risks to him, and they're myriad. They include, not least, the fact that he could get cancer doing this, because to get this rare transplant surgery that would give him vision, he would have to ingest massive doses of wicked anti-rejection drugs, the kind that are meant only for people whose lives are on the line at the moment, liver transplants, heart transplants, kidneys, you know, things like that. They're not for healthy people. And so there's a significant risk of cancer with that. So he's risking dying in order to see. But there's other risks, too, and that is the fact that there's only been 15 cases. I mean, that was unimaginable to me when I found this out. Only 15 cases known to history in which a person had lived a life blind and then gained vision. And in every one of those cases, every one, the results were profoundly disappointing and depressing for the individual. There was severe depression in every case. There was suicidal thoughts, clawing at the eyes, fury at the surgeon who cured them. And in the saddest case of a man in Britain in the late 1950s, he died prematurely from, get this, disappointment. And so this was the history Mike was facing going through with this, not just the risk of cancer, but the certainty that the result could be only profound disappointment and depression. And yet, speaking to his curiosity, the idea that he could do something rarer than stepping on the moon overcame this all. And a year after the offer was made, he called the surgeon and he said, I'm in.
He began to see this as something of an adventure, and he knew that it would be something that could make a big difference, not only in his life, but in the lives of others as well. You write, of course, so profoundly about this incredible moment when the bandages come off, and indeed, Mike May can see. But it is an overwhelming experience in many respects. Before we get to some of his struggles, talk for a moment about this odd matter of assessing his vision and the fact that in one way his vision, once his sight had been restored, was 20/40, and yet in another respect was 20/800. Help us make sense of those bewildering numbers.
Right, and that's one of the keys to understanding the amazingness of his story and the beauty of his story. His eye was restored to 20/40, and by the way, today it's 20/20. So he was, within the first second of getting his bandages off, good enough to have a driver's license in California. He was able, within hours of getting his bandages off, to play a rough game of catch with footballs and soccer balls in his backyard, where he was making spectacular over-the-shoulder running catches. Okay? He was able to ride his bike down the street. And yet, at the same time, he was not able in any way to understand or even perceive human faces. Now, he could see the faces, but they made no sense to him, so he could not tell his wife from the UPS delivery driver. He could not tell his children apart. And even stranger, he could not see in depth. Unless something was moving, like a flying football or him on a bicycle, the world looked flat to him, like a modern abstract painting, a flat representation of colorful but meaningless shapes. And he couldn't remember things, so he would have to learn that, okay, that thing is a television remote. But if someone put the television remote where it didn't belong, in other words, changed its context, he didn't see it anymore. It was just another shape to him.
Another gray rectangle.
Another gray rectangle. Hmm. He had to think about almost everything he saw, unless it was colors or motion. And that became incredibly difficult for him.
We see the word exhausting over and over in the pages of the book as you are describing these first months where he is trying to take in the experience of sight. For instance, when he goes to see his first stage work, the musical Rent, his first word to describe it is exhausting. I mean, it's exciting and amazing, but it's exhausting. At another point, you describe this as cognitive heavy lifting. This was the cognitive heavy lifting required of May virtually everywhere and always. He saw almost nothing automatically. He was assembling clues around the clock. I mean, it's really hard to imagine what it would be like to live with that.
Think about this. Wherever you are right now, you know, if you're having a discussion with somebody in the room you are in right now, you focus on them, but there's a world of things to your side and back of you, all kinds of background objects that we absolutely instantaneously, unconsciously, and automatically tune out, right? So we can focus on the one thing we're looking at, if it's a person, if it's a television, whatever. Nothing in the background registers with us. Mike did not know how to do that. Every single thing in his field of vision was just as important as everything else, and he had to say to himself, the person who's talking is the important thing. Don't look at that light over there. Don't look at that window over there. Don't look at that refrigerator over there. Every moment he had his eyes open. When people spoke to him, he could not take his eyes off the fact that they gestured with their hands or that people raised their eyebrows when they spoke. These were incredibly distracting things because he didn't know which things were the right things to pay attention to and which weren't. So imagine having to try to sort that kind of thing every minute of every day. Go very tired very fast, and that is the underpinning to the disastrous results that every one of his predecessors had. They expected to open their eyes and see the world effortlessly and immediately like we do, and yet it was a tremendous strain and burden required of them every second.
Right.
And that's a huge problem.
Right. And, of course, it took enormous courage to do this, and his wife Jennifer realizes this at one point when they are having one of their first intimate moments as husband and wife where he has now sight. And she said she knew she was watching a kind of birth, and she tried to imagine the kind of love and courage it took to allow another person to watch you being born. I mean, that's the kind of emotional cost to this that I'm sure none of the previous people, it never would have dawned on them for them or for those who cared about them. And really for Mike May, too, he went into this not fully aware of just what the emotional cost would be. Tell us about the woman who ends up providing the great breakthrough of understanding and why this was all such a struggle.
Well, I'm so glad you asked about his wife, Jennifer, because without her, I don't know that any of this could have unfolded like it did. There are, in the case histories, those ones that are so disastrous, there's often a family member, it's a spouse or maybe a fiancé who is hoping, praying that with vision, everything will change and things will be magically better and the person can be just like everybody else. In Jennifer's case, not only did she not hope or expect that, she said, whatever happens, we're going to roll with it together. And it was a big risk, because think about it. Marriages are finely balanced equations in the best of times. But to introduce a change so fundamental to the vision, you don't know what's going to happen, how that affects things. It could have easily understood her to say, let's not mess with this. We got a good thing going. And then people said to her, hey, look, what if he doesn't like what you look like? And it seems like a crazy question, but if you go back in the histories, that happened. In one of those best-known case histories, the guy was made to see and found not only his wife, but himself to be unbearably ugly. Hmm. So, you know, you never know. And she was willing to risk whatever the consequences were because she knew her husband needed to speak to his curiosity. And then when he got this vision, it was such a strange thing. And he couldn't, for example, do one of the things he really wanted to do, which was to see beautiful women, because he couldn't tell men from women. She took him out to the coffee shop, sat him on the table outside, and taught him how to girl watch. Say, look, if you can't see the faces, look for flowing skirts, look for colored shoes. She gave him the clues, which not every woman would have done necessarily.
Of course. She provides all kinds of help. And ultimately, Mike May comes to a breakthrough of understanding as to why he was struggling as he was. Just summarize for us in whatever time remains how he was able to, in a sense, break through some of these barriers and begin to see the world without a sense of it being such a terrible burden.
Right. He had to learn to relax and to let the world come to him. So it became a very difficult, threatening thing for him when he, and this is Mike May, if he puts his mind to something, he can always figure it out. And the more he put his mind to vision, the worse he got at it. He tried to think it through harder, he tried to get faster, and things got more and more difficult. Until he finally had this kind of epiphany that if he didn't try to see the way normally sighted people see, if he tried to figure a new way to see, one that was just particular to him, in which he used clues and was like a detective, building a database of clues, he might be able to see in a different way, in a way that no one else in history has ever seen the world. And that's the project he undertook. That's the last part of the book in Crashing Through. And it's an amazing breakthrough he makes. And he becomes the first person for whom this is not a tragedy, and in fact, for whom it's a miracle.
And we read this story in your amazing book, again called Crashing Through, A True Story of Risk, Adventure, and the Man Who Dared to See. Random House is the publisher, Robert Kersen, the author. Robert Kersen, thank you for writing such a magnificent book.
And thank you for just about the best questions I've ever been asked. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the third and final portion of today's program, we are again going into the Morning Show archives, this time to a conversation recorded and initially broadcast back in 2014. This is an interview that concerns professional wrestling and its dark side. I thought it would be appropriate to play this interview today, since right now in movie theaters across the country, there is a major motion picture called The Iron Claw, which takes a look at the tragic true life story of the Von Erich family. So here is this conversation from 2014. Well, listeners to The Morning Show who think of me mostly as a classical music guy with a love for opera and, of course, part of the world of public radio may be astonished to know that once upon a time I was a rabid fan of professional wrestling, and not only a fan, but a fervent believer that what was transpiring in that ring was absolutely real. And of course, at some point, we come to find out that that it wasn't real, or at least not real in the simplest sense of the word. But that doesn't mean that what doesn't happen in the world of professional wrestling isn't truly compelling. And and it can be a tragic arena. And the history of professional wrestling is explored in a very fascinating new book called The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. The author is David Shoemaker, also known as the Masked Man, who's been writing about wrestling for a number of years. And this book is published by Gotham Books, and I'm very excited for this opportunity to speak with David Shoemaker about The Squared Circle. David Shoemaker, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, man. It's so good to be on here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Can you explain to our listeners the also known as the Masked Man part?
Well, you know, every wrestling has his gimmick or his character. When I first started writing, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, my editor thought it'd be funny to make me the Masked Man. A lot of thought really didn't go into it, but it ended up being a really cool thing for my career because I was an unestablished writer, but you know, all the readers started trying to guess who I was as if I was some reputable sports writer who was slumming it writing about wrestling. That's kind of the same way that, you know, the master wrestler gimmick has worked throughout history too. You put a nobody under a mask and all of a sudden he's a deadly, you know, destroyer. But hopefully, you know, through writing about wrestling on the web and now in this book, The Squared Circle, I've you know, hopefully shown that you don't have to slum it to be a wrestling writer. You can, you know, it's a crazy sport, but it's part of the fabric of our country, and it's, you know, it's ridiculous, but it's you know, it's nothing to be embarrassed by.
Right. You mentioned that the roots of what we think of as professional wrestling today can be traced back to a couple of variations that maybe we've seen here and there on a old episode of Bonanza or something. I mean, something really out of our distant national past. Remind our listeners about the earliest roots of what we think of now as professional wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, when I started writing the book, I decided I was going to start it when, you know, it's a history of pro wrestling, so I wanted to start when wrestling became fake, because really, the sort of fakery is the most intrinsic part of it, right? So I go all the way back to, you know, the earliest days of the 20th century and like the early 1900s in small town America, where they would have these carnivals that would just travel from town to town, and they were the best source of entertainment for most of the people that lived in the country. And one of the exhibitions they'd have would be a pro wrestling exhibition where they would wrestle each other for everybody and then invite local tough guys up to try to compete. And just like everything else on the carnival sideshow, it was fixed. You know, there was no way you were going to get one over on these wrestlers. Then when, you know, cities started growing up, they started getting their own, you know, this evolved into separate little wrestling promotions that stayed in each city. And then on and on until it's now the WWE is this major national company, but it never lost its carny roots. You know, it's always been a put on from the very beginning.
Right. Although it's interesting, I at several points in your book, particularly in its preface, you kind of make that point that everybody's, in a sense, in on the joke to some extent, unless you're a little kid. I mean, I remember watching professional wrestling and roller derby, and yeah, absolutely believing what was transpiring before my eyes. And I still vividly remember my parents observing me watching this, and then them saying, you know, all of these people who, you know, are trying to bash their heads in, they all go out for dinner after it's all over. I mean, the yeah, Los Angeles Thunderbirds and the Kansas City Bombers, I mean, and the whoever was just wrestling, they all go out for dinner together, and they laugh and joke around and stuff. And I remember thinking, you are so stupid, I can't believe you think that. And of course, someday you come to the realization that, yeah, they probably do all go out for dinner when it's all done. But I yeah, mean, there has to be, beyond children, probably certain people who are not as fully aware as the rest of us that this is all scripted entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I found quotes throughout going back as far as like the 1915 or 1913 or stuff like that, where people are talking about, you know, openly acknowledging that wrestling is fake or being aware of it. But you're right. The process that you were talking about people trying to tell you the truth, is it's called in the business smartening up. You know, sometimes you got to smarten up some fans so they know what's going on. But, you know, I mean, there are people, obviously, that believe it more than other people. I sometimes relate it to, like, you know, an aunt or a grandmother who watches soap operas. And it's not that she thinks soap operas are real per se, but she'll talk about the characters as if they're real, you know?
Right.
And I think it's that. I mean, part of what makes wrestling work is this unspoken agreement between the fans and the wrestlers to that we're going to interact as if it's a real sport.
Right.
And some people are more invested in that than others. But that's what really makes wrestling work. And even if you know that it's fake, if you're a person like me or you who's fully aware of it, what really makes for the juiciest moments or the kind of moments of greatest passion when you watch it are moments where you're not sure anymore.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
That moment where you think, well, I know this is a put on, but those two guys on the screen, I read on the internet that they don't like each other, and now they're kind of acting like they really don't like each other, you know? And it's those ways that it can play with reality versus unreality that kind of makes it one of the most compelling things going.
And of course, it's intriguing the variations that one also finds between the glitziest forms of professional wrestling, which, as you say, fully, gleefully embrace the fakery. In a way that wasn't true, versus other brands of professional wrestling that are less on the national spotlight, but which are not quite so glitzy and glamorous, and which seem to be trying to present to the public something which comes off as much more earnest, much more truthful in a sense, even if it too is scripted to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, listen, when the WWF went national in the 80s and brought Hulk Hogan into everybody's home every week, it changed wrestling a lot, you know? I mean, Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan were showmen at their very core, and you know, it was a lot of kind of just pantomime on a sort of mythological level, you know? I mean, it wasn't nearly as real as the kind of territorial operations that had been, you know, in all over the country and in the South, you know, just for a long period of time, where people, it was just tough-looking guys who would beat each other up. And now you kind of see that same parallel today with, you know, the WWE is still kind of family-friendly entertainment, this sort of wacky technicolor. And then there's like indie wrestling companies around that, starting with places like ECW back in the 90s, emphasize, you know, real brutality in the ring. It's all put on, but there's lots of blood. There's lots of, you know, they hit each other with weapons. They you know, it's a pretty brutal form. And it's like you said, even though you know it's fake, you know, there's nothing fake about getting hit with a chair and busting yourself open.
Right.
You know? And so that's part of what wrestling is always playing around with.
You tell us the full story of some of wrestling's greatest legends, including wrestlers like Gorgeous George from years ago or more to our own day, like Andre Giant and Macho Man Randy Savage and so on. I really appreciated the fact that you also took time to introduce us to a wrestler called S.D. Jones, not so much for his specific story, but the kind of wrestler that he is, a jobber or a preliminary wrestler or an enhancement talent. Tell our listeners what these wrestlers are all about.
Yeah, I decided if I wanted to cover the whole wrestling world, then I had to have a jobber in there. I mean, there is this sort of it's a little bit less today because, you know, every match has to be meaningful in this sort of, you know, fast-forward society that we're in. But yeah, back in the 80s and in the 70s, when I grew up watching wrestling, the vast majority of matches were, you know, an established star versus a nobody. Just it looked like some guy off the street in the, you know, spandex singlet. They would put him in there and they'd get him body slammed a couple of times and dropped on their head, and that would be the end of it. S.D. Jones was probably the most famous jobber, and it was because WWF, you know, made him a star. They made him a guy that you would recognize and you could associate with. But he never won. Sometimes he beat other jobbers. All these ham and eggers was the other word for him. But his most important role was to be recognizable, and then to get beat up really quickly by, you know, established stars, which culminated most famously in his WrestleMania match against King Kong Bundy, where he got just slammed and lost in world record time.
You also point out that in the days when there were various Midwestern or regional wrestling companies, that in many cases there would be a world champion who would get farmed out to these different constituencies around the country. And often in those situations,
that world champion would be brought in to make the champion of that region look good. I mean, not that he would lose, but there would often be scripted as a very tight battle, which in a sense would elevate the stature of some of these regional wrestlers to make them look even more imposing by, oh my gosh, pushing world champion Jack Briscoe right to the edge. And I mean, I think that's really interesting because it really shows another level of sophistication in terms of figuring out who's going to win and who's going to lose and why.
Yeah. I mean, that was an incredible era. And the territorial era is what I call it in my book. And it was this period where every major city had its own wrestling company, basically. Most of them were united under the banner of the NWA, the National Wrestling Association. But yeah, I mean, they would have their own show. And if you lived in St. Louis or you lived in, you know, Seattle or you lived in Dallas, pretty much as far as you were concerned, the biggest wrestling show in the world was happening right there in your town.
Absolutely.
You know, there wasn't cable until when cable television started up and the WWF, and then, you know, at first it was championship wrestling from Georgia, but you know, local places would started going on national TV. That kind of undermined everything. No one could think they were all alone in the world anymore. But yeah, back in those days, the only way that you had to know that there was something bigger going on was when Jack Briscoe or Ric Flair or whoever the national champion was would come to town, and always almost lose to your local champion. You're right. It's weird, but they always have to find a new and exciting way to tell the story so that you know, you don't necessarily lose by losing.
Right. And, of course, a big part of your book is the dramatic and often tragic stories of many leading wrestlers who have died way too young, occasionally dying in the ring from a tragic accident, and more often than not, dying because of health issues related to maybe the ingesting of steroids or other facets of the lifestyle. Can you just say a word about this darker side of the world of professional wrestling and how difficult it was to get the true story behind some of these tragic figures?
Well, I'll start with the end first. I mean, in a world that's built on fantasy, getting to the truth is incredibly difficult. That's part of why I focus on what some of these guys mean in a sort of broader metaphorical sense, because as a fan, what they mean to us is almost more important than who they really are. And that's a truth that I can get to. But, you know, a lot of these guys, even if they're trying to tell you the truth, they've been steeped in this fake world for so long that the line's blurry to them too, and which is an incredibly interesting part of the story. But yeah, I mean, the wrestling industry is brutal. You know, as much as these guys just seem like invincible superheroes when we see them on TV, you know, people will tell you that, I mean, they've done studies where a wrestling match is like playing a game of football on the offensive line. And, you know, what NFL players do it 16 times a year and professional wrestlers do it 200 or 250 or sometimes 300. Mm. And then after every match, you got to, you know, go out at night and then wake up and do it all over again and maybe drive in a compact car with three 300-pound guys for 300 miles in between, you know? I mean, it's a really, really tough life, and it's something that these guys really have to commit themselves to. But it's not, you know, I mean, it's not just the brutality of the sport, but like I was saying with the unreality of it, I mean, these guys a lot of times start believing their own hype and start believing that they're invincible, even if it's only, you know, painkillers and steroids that's allowing them to believe that. It's a tough life. And it's really, at the end of the day, what intrigues me is the way it underscores the difference between the gods we see on TV and the mere mortals that you know, live the lives the rest of the time.
Mm. The book is The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling, published by Gotham Books. It's author David Shoemaker. David Shoemaker, congratulations on writing a fascinating book.
Thanks so much for having me on, man. Thank you.
Monday on the morning show, Julie Farnham and her fascinating book called Domestic Darkness, which is a look at the January 6th insurrection from her vantage point as Assistant Director of Intelligence for the Capitol Police. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois, cloudy and mild with more light rain and fog intermittently all day long. Today's high 40 degrees. A 50-50 chance of still more rain and likely fog as well overnight with a low of 55. Cloudy skies tomorrow as well. High temperature right around 40 degrees. These conditions are expected to continue until next Wednesday when we finally see sunshine in the forecast. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.